I'm David Whelan. I'm a TV producer by trade. I come from London initially, 58 years old now. And in 2020, the dreaded lockdown, I heard on a podcast, a JFK podcast, about the doorman of the Dakota when John Lennon got assassinated, possibly being a CIA operative. And that just piqued my interest. And from that point onwards, I started to investigate the case. And the more I unraveled, the more I realized everything we've been told about it was wrong.
Well, the book's called Mind Games, The Assassination of John Lennon. But can you tell us a bit about your life in television and how you get into
that? Sure. Yeah, love to. Yeah, it's not a direct route. I was brought up by a single mother, so I didn't have the best background, best childhood. So school was indifferent to me and I was fairly indifferent to school. So I went to a rather horrific Catholic North London school, which is a topic for another conversation, for another day, another podcast. But basically what I'm trying to say in a very bad way is by the time I got to 17, I was at a bit of a loose end, had a few O-levels to my name, no desire to go on to A-levels and university. I came from the kind of household where the name university was never mentioned. I don't think actually anyone in my family even knew what a university was. So I kind of could have gone down a very bad path. It was highly possible. But incredibly, Tony, I found out about a youth training scheme at Thames Television in the film department. And I applied, thinking I'd have no chance of getting in. And I managed to get onto a youth training scheme 1 year, secondment to the film department at Thames Television. And the second I walked through that door, Tony, it was just like, my eyes just were opened up to, obviously, let's be honest, the glamour of it all. There was people I saw on the TV was just kind of walking around. But also the people who worked in there at the time at Thames Television were very forward-thinking, very interesting, obviously highly educated, but it was quite politicised as well.
Yeah, but I mean, hang on, because Thames wasn't so, actually, if you compare to today, much really about the glamour. I mean, the film department, I think, was it Euston Films?
No, Euston Films was a separate department to the film department. The film department just meant where all the editing went on and where all the kind of production went down. The film department was more of a kind of editing floor, really.
I was getting really excited for a minute there because the things like Riley Ace of Spies, Sweeney, all that
happening. Yeah, that was happening, but Euston Films' office was actually across the road from where Thames was, because Thames was on Euston Road, as you probably know, next to the Capital Radio building in London. It was wonderful. It was real central London at the time. And Euston Films had an office just across the road. And so it was a kind of separate entity. And a lot of what Euston Films did was make programs that were sold all across the globe. So it was more of a kind of international distributor as well as a producer.
What era are we talking about?
We're talking 83 when I first turned up at Thames. And it was a life-changing moment, Tony. I just suddenly realized just how interesting life can be. And just, it was, you know, it was very unionized at the time. The wages were incredible. We were really well looked after. The canteen was just a banquet every day for 20p. There was a bar, a subsidized bar. The social scene there was incredible. It was a bit like Mad Men, really. There was a lot of drinking. It was quite hedonistic, actually, to be honest. A lot of parties. But it was just some really interesting people there, Tony. And what's really, you remember this because you come from this sphere. In those days, when documentaries were made, they would not get made unless they had something new to say, or as an investigation where they're uncovering something. When you fast forward to today, where you go on Netflix and Amazon and Apple and you see these glossy documentaries with great music and, you know, fantastic archive, but they don't actually tell you anything you haven't heard before or you don't already know. So it's all very safe and boring. I think in those days you had what was called, if you remember, World in Action, which came out of Manchester. But you had CDI, which was the kind of London production of documentary strands. And every week these guys were uncovering new stuff, you know, and they were really bright. In the end, it did for them, Tony. I don't know if you remember the Death on the Rock debacle at Thames. Do you remember that?
Well, yes, yeah. That was into the SAS assassinations of IRA.
That's right.
In Gibraltar. And the Mrs. Thatcher didn't like that. In fact, the 1980s, so much was going on, wasn't it? Not only the sort of opening up of the the national treasure to any bidder, and also getting rid of exchange control so money can flow in and out of the country willy-nilly. You know, privatisation. We had things like the Wapping dispute, the miners' strike, the Battle of the Beanfield, which was, you know, smashing the whole sort of traveller movements at Stonehenge, that sort of thing. But so, how did you come to start producing stuff at Thames? And what, are there any sort of real memorable programmes from those days in the mid-80s?
Well, yeah, my Thames work, to be honest with you, Tony, I was only 17, so I wasn't really producing at Thames. My producing work came after Thames, and that was mainly in the kind of sports sphere. But what happened with what was great about Thames was Thames allowed you to move around. So if you wanted to go to a different department, they just said, yeah, sure, you know, you can go and work there for a few months, see if you like it. It was incredibly, you know, open for people to.
I think it's fair that these independent private production companies that had the franchises like Thames, so they were originally, it was like a license to print money, they said, because of the
advertising revenue.
But the idea was that this was going to basically stick two fingers up in the at the BBC, which was seen as very stuffy, and say, look, this is how it can be done and should be done.
Yeah, it was much more, Thames was much more creative. You know, you came to the BBC, didn't you, at the time? And I spent, you know, I used to go and visit friends who worked in the BBC. And I've got to be honest with you, Tony, crossing that divide from commercial television at Thames into the BBC, it was a bit like going from a kind of creative, artistic space into a bank. You know, because everybody just sat there, just bored, and there was just no spark, there was no fun.
Well, you know what, GLR, Marylebone High Street, is we were doing everything we could to break the mould of the bank.
Yeah.
You're right, you know, Broadcasting House was very much more like that. It was very rigidly sort of controlled, a bit sort of airless and Masonic, you know, but GLR, where we were in Marylebone High Street, which was a very popular station, you know, we were doing the opposite. So, anyway, so how did you, you know, give us some idea of from the mid-80s how you started getting into actually producing and what you were doing?
Well, what happened was, another big moment for me was, I think it was about 87, there was a film came out, I think it was Taylor Hackford, the director, it's called Broadcast News. Do you remember that film? It was about an American news network, and I popped down to my local Blockbuster and got that video out, as you did back in those days. And I watched Broadcast News, and at the time, I think I was assistant film editor at the time. By that point, I'd kind of worked my way up to sync up rushes. Remember the old syncing up rushes in those days of the film? It was all film in the early days. And I remember thinking, I was getting a bit bored of syncing up rushes, and I thought, I want to kind of move on and do something a little bit more interesting. And when I saw that film, I thought, wow, news looks really good. I think I quite like to work in news. And what happened was I asked to go and get seconded as a researcher in Thames News. You remember Thames News? You know, the Thames Television's London news station. Do you remember that? So basically, went to Thames News as a researcher. Said, yeah, sure, you can go and work at Thames News, which was brilliant. And that was a newsroom. That was really buzzy. And that made me realise that, you know, news is not what it sort of pertains to be. I got to see how it worked between the editor and the sub-editor and the journalists, and I got to see how a lot of journalists were into it for truth. A lot of journalists were into it because they wanted to read the news, and they were into they liked the fame side of things. And I also got to see how every story, before it was covered, was kind of preordained. So before they went out, they knew exactly what angle to pursue. And it was kind of, it wasn't written down on a memo, but it was kind of, it was just the unknown kind of feeling that everyone had in the department that this is the particular story about this particular event, and this is how we're going to cover it, and we're not going to be looking left, we're not going to be looking right, we're not going to be looking under any stones. We're just going to stick to the facts that have already been laid out.
I mean, the editors can. I mean, it's a bit like a chair of a committee. You know, they completely dominate the flavour of what comes out of it, and an editor can be. I've worked under excellent news editors and also under appalling news editors. So the actual character of the person in charge completely, I mean, if you look, actually look back at the origin of the word editor, it comes from the old Roman gladiatorial contests, as the editor was the person that sort of oversaw that. So, in a way, you can see why this word is quite appropriate, because that can be either an absolute, well, I suppose there is an element of entertainment to punishment, maybe, but it can also become incredibly gory, nasty, and vicious. So that seems to be something that many people, even in journalism, don't understand where this word editor actually comes from.
Exactly. And well, another big event that happened in 85, Tony, which is relevant to the Lennon investigation that I did, was Death on the Rock. And I think it's important to say to your listeners what happened there briefly. Basically, the IRA, an IRA operative team was shot, unarmed, I think they were unarmed, at a gas station in Gibraltar. They were planning a bomb attack. The SAS took them out, and basically Thames managed to get some witnesses. I think it was TVI that did the actual documentary strand, but they managed to get some witnesses, and they wanted to do this documentary about this shoot-to-kill policy that the SAS had. Now, I don't want to get into whether they should have done that or not, but they chose to do that editorially. They thought that we've got something here; it's in the public interest to let people know that these SAS guys.
Well, yeah, but it's important to say that this was a shoot-to-kill. It wasn't an arrest and trial.
Exactly.
The idea was to blow these people's brains out and not bother to give them a trial.
Exactly. And Mrs. Thatcher was, I think, quoted as being beyond fury when Thames actually broadcasted it, because she tried for many, many months to get them to pull it. But they broadcasted it. And at the time, but then what Thatcher then did was she changed the franchise awarding rules, where it used to be just on quality, which Thames was pretty good at. But then she changed it to quality and money. So whoever bidded the highest financial bid could actually beat someone over quality. And apparently the two were supposed to be combined. But of course, you know, money was obviously going to talk. And the person who actually won the next franchise that came up was a guy called Michael Green, who was, I believe, at the time, either married to or going out with a Tory minister's daughter. I believe so. Michael Green was very much a kind of Tory insider.
Well, that's right. I mean, this was a Thatcher takeover, really.
Exactly.
And they did the same at the BBC by getting rid of Alastair Milne, who was quite independent-minded. I mean, people don't realise how television completely swerved, changed direction 180 degrees into something which was controlled, safe,
yeah,
and also safe for money and safe for adverts. But the end result of this, I suppose, with Death on the Rock, was, I mean, how did it go down at Thames?
Well, what's interesting is everyone felt quite kind of good about it, that was part of that actual programme. And I wasn't part of that programme, by the way. I was still, you know, I was only been there 2 years at the time. I was still very junior in 85. But I knew the people who did it, and, you know, they seemed quite happy, and they were very sort of content with their decision to actually broadcast it. But there was an unease with other people that, you know, we're poking a very dangerous bear here. And when Thatcher did change the franchise rules, we started to get a little bit uneasy. And I remember being in the Thames newsroom when the franchise award kind of announcement came over the airways, and we were all there with our champagne thinking Thames are going to just get this. This is no problem. Because everyone knew Michael Green and Colton. There was no real plan there. It was just, he tried before Michael Green to get into the Thames franchise, but no one took him very seriously. And when Carlton were awarded, he called his new station Carlton Michael Green. When they were awarded the franchise and Thames lost it, it was a real kind of historical moment. I just looked around the newsroom and everybody was absolutely stunned and shocked. And what's interesting, Sonny, from that point on, there's been a lot of debate. You know, I'm in various sort of online groups with Thames, old Thames staff. We meet up every year, you know, and have a reunion and stuff. And there's been a debate ever since, really, with Thames staff about should we have broadcast that programme. Because if we didn't broadcast that programme, I'm pretty sure Thames would still be going today. And then you get down to that kind of integrity question. And, you know, can you look at yourself in the mirror? And, you know, did we do the right thing by, you know, putting what we thought was, you know, important information out to the public, or should we
made
it a bit safer?
The media now, most of what's on there has got zero integrity, even though those people who are fighting to get it out, actually there's quite a lot of good people working in there. It's like almost like there is this sort of veto, you know, if anyone starts getting really close to the really powerful that ain't going to happen. And so that, yeah, well, that seems to be the way things are. People have been kind of chased onto social media, haven't they, over the years. Anyone that really wants to find out what's going on, or journalists that want to get their material out, have to go onto places like Substack or YouTube in order to try and get a little bit of payback for their hard work. And now it seems COVID and post-COVID, even that is being supposed, well, it is, it's beginning to be closed down. And we've seen most recently, we've seen J.D. Vance over in Europe saying, what the hell do you think you're doing? You know, you need a free press if you're going to have democracy in Europe. So this is still very much a live debate, isn't it?
100%, 100%. And, you know, Thames for me was a real salient lesson. And I, you know, I've wrestled with it in my mind because, you know, for me, as I say, Thames really looked after its staff. You know, I was earning incredible money at a very young age, as everyone was there. You know, the union was very powerful, perhaps too powerful, maybe in hindsight. And, you know, there was just way too many people that were sent out on jobs. You know, you had, you know, I remember Margaret Thatcher famously, a BBC crew turned up at Downing Street to do an interview with her. And I think there was about four people there. And then a week later, a Thames crew turned up to do an interview at Downing Street, and there was about 20, and she made a comment about it. So, you know, what world is people doing here? And it did get a bit silly. It went too far the other way. I think when a union becomes too powerful, it just gets a little bit out of hand. But ultimately, management did well. The workers did well. You know, nobody went hungry at Thames, and it was just a really happy, vibrant, creative place to work. And you know, we all walk past that Euston Road space where Thames Television's buildings used to be. It's all been knocked down now, incredibly.
It's almost like they were the Thames were almost like the MCs of London life. You know, they were kind of fairly safe. I mean, the idea that, you know, you could watch something knowing that the people who made that film were looking out for you and were kind of on your side as a viewer or a listener.
100%.
Particularly if it came to holding government to account, there's very little of that. But anyway, you've recently published this book on John Lennon.
Yeah,
I just wonder, were you also a Beatles fan, and what made you start? You mentioned that something about the guy who was the sort of doorman or something just inside the concierge or something.
I'm not a big Beatles fan. I love music, so everyone who loves music likes some Beatles. It's impossible to like music and not like the Beatles. But they weren't, you know, I was too young. When Lennon was assassinated, I was only 14. And I was, you know, in 1980, I was more into the Jam, to be honest with you, than John Lennon, some old rocker from the 60s, as I would have seen him at 14. But the reason I fell into this was another big moment for me was the Oliver Stone JFK film in 91. I went to see that, and I, you know, everyone talks about 9/11 being their red pill moment, but that film for me was my red pill moment. I thought it was very well done. And then I got into Jim Mars's Crossfire book after that, and I just realised, oh wow, intelligence agencies are not James Bond. they're a bit out of control and can do bad things as well as good. So, but that took me down a JFK assassination investigation that has never really stopped me. I've always been fascinated with that case. It's just so labyrinth, and there's just so many strands to it. And of course, with Trump allegedly releasing the files, it's all become quite.
Well, we'll see. I mean, certainly my investigations into that, I think, have completely bottomed out the tale, which is that the Chicago Mafia were hired by the Central Intelligence Agency to get rid of Kennedy, and they came down from Chicago down to Dallas. Charles Nicoletti, Johnny Roselli in the Dow Tech building, firing at him from behind. A couple of shots hit him, but not fatal shots. And then James Files on the grassy knoll, X-82nd Airborne with a Remington fireball, blew the back of John F. Kennedy's head off. So it was David Attlee Phillips, who was the controller, is the technical term, at the CIA for the operation. And bizarrely, the Chicago mob people, a report having, or the only one surviving, which is James Files, reports having got a call the day before saying we think we might want to call it off, and actually the Chicago mob said no, we're going to carry on with it. And the main motive for the Chicago mob getting involved was that I think it was Bobby Kennedy had got money from the Chicago mob to as part of his electoral campaign funds. And then when he got in as Attorney General under his brother, he announced he was going to try and close down the mob in Chicago. So they got very angry with him. You know, we've just given you a load of money and you're going to kind of shut us down. And so there was a lot of personal motives. A lot of it was to do with Cuba. But anyway, that's my quick take. So what do you make of it?
Well, I think you've hit a key word there for me is Cuba. I think, you know, as you know, after Castro took power, a lot of a kind of Western friendly, hates to use the word right wing, but you know what I'm saying, people who are more on the kind of right side of things, who didn't want to be under a Castro communist regime in Cuba, they came to Miami, they came to Florida, and a lot of those guys started to work for the intelligence agencies, as you know, and there's one group called Operation 40, which was a group of assassins that were going to go in, and this has all been documented, I'm not talking hypothetically here, we know Operation 40 existed, and it was a group of Cuban anti-Castro kind of operatives who were kind of training to be assassins, and they were soldiers of fortune, they were mercenaries. A lot of these guys did stuff for many decades after the 60s. But there was a group that got into sort of got put together just before the Bay of Pigs, and their job, Operation 40, was to go in, and after the Bay of Pigs was a success, was to kind of clean up and do the kind of Nazi secret police kind of job where if you're not going along with the new regime, we're just going to take you out, we're going to take you to a building and dispose of you. So they're a really nasty bunch.
This is what the Nazis used to call the Einsatzgruppen. Yeah, exactly. So they would kind of clear up and kill anybody that wasn't completely pliable and compliant, and quite a lot that were.
Exactly. And the guy who ran Operation 40 was a Cuban guy and a CIA officer. His name was Jose Padermo. You see, Jose Sanginas Padermo. So that's a fact. And this guy is very mysterious. And whether he died in the mid-70s or whether he died in the 80s, no one really knows. Obviously, these kind of people are kind of ghosts. There's never been a verified picture of this guy. But after the John Lennon assassination, what happened was, Tony, in 1987, a journalist called Jim Gaines wrote an article in People magazine, wrote three articles, was the first guy to get access to Mark Chapman. And in this article, 7 years after the fact, he released the information that the doorman at the Vic Hotel when John was assassinated was a guy called Jose Padermo. And Jose Padermo, this doorman, according to Jim Gaines, spoke to Mark Chapman about the Bay of Pigs, the JFK assassination, and Castro. So what people did pre-internet is they went off researching, and said, oh, we finally got this doorman's name. Why did they hold this guy's name back for 7 years? And they went off, and they started to research Jose Padermo and Bay of Pigs, and they discovered that Operation 40 Bay of Pigs was called Jose Padermo. So instantly, they all put it together and said, oh, well, it must be the same guy, but the problem is, Tony, it's not the same guy, and Jose Padermo is a very common, popular name in Cuba. So the first thing I did when I found out on this podcast in lockdown, getting back to our original discussion of how I got started on this, I was listening to a JFK assassination podcast called Black Ops Radio, and someone on there mentioned that the doorman at the Dakota may have been a CIA operative, and I thought, okay, that's really interesting. It's lockdown, I've got time on my hands, I'm going to go home and check out who this guy is. And pretty much everyone online, just at the time, 4 years or 5 years ago now, said, oh yeah, Jose Padermo was CIA Jose Padermo. It's a fact, because, you know, he spoke to Chapman about Cuba, and he spoke to Chapman about the Bay of Pigs. It must be the same guy. So I thought, okay, well, I need to, you know, try and figure out if this conspiracy is true. And it's not true. It didn't take me long to find out that the birth dates were wrong, that Dakota Jose started working at Dakota in 69, that this was 4 years before the Lennons even moved in, and obviously 11 years before the assassination. So it's just not the kind, and their birth dates were wrong, and I found out about who Dakota Jose's family was and stuff. It was just a different guy. It wasn't the same operative. And of course, a group of assassins leader, who was a serious dude himself, he's not going to go and work the door at the Dakota. It's just not what that guy's going to do. It's possible, you know, as a plant, it might have been, but, you know, he's not going to go there in the hope that John Lennon might turn up in 4 years' time and start living there. So it was clearly a different person. So I kind of started this investigation disproving a conspiracy. But of course, what's interesting is, funny, once my work came out, you can imagine everyone called me a conspiracy theorist, when actually I'd like to think my book is a true crime book that actually dispels as many conspiracies as it sort of lays open.
Well, I know, and it's pretty forensic, I'll tell you that. You've gone through doing everything you possibly can. I think it very well to stand up what you're saying. But let's just remind listeners what happened. I mean, obviously, John was an extremely wonderful guy. I mean, he encapsulated much of what you could say was like 60s, 70s British culture. In 1980, we're talking about here, he'd moved to New York. And
he moved in 73, but yeah, he was living in New York in 1980, yeah.
He decided to go to America and make his fortune. And so it's almost like, you know, the lure of Hollywood or something. But I think he also felt that that was more where it was at.
Well, Yoko was part of that decision. I think they first moved to New York in 71, and Yoko spent a lot of time in New York in her art career. In her early art career in the 60s. So New York to her was a kind of...
So she dragged him. What do you make of Yoko? Can we just say something about her? He was into this Eastern mysticism, and in a way, it's almost like he wanted to find somebody like Yoko, so Yoko turned up on the scene.
Okay, Yoko. Wow, where do I start with Yoko? First thing I'll say about Yoko is I've spoken to a lot of people who work with her at the Dakota, before the murder and after the murder. I spoke to a lot of people who were around in the Beatles kind of era who knew her when she first came on the scene. And I've never met such a despised human being in all my life. They all absolutely despise her, which is interesting. And the people that, you know, some people who knew her at the time were convinced, I'm not going to say who they are to protect them, because Yoko is still very much alive. And, you know, she's no longer running the estate, but they do have a billion, you know, the Leonard estate does have a $1 billion fortune behind them. So you don't want to be messing around with billionaires. What I will say is that a lot of people who knew her at the time thought she was somehow involved in the murder, which is interesting. There's no actual hard evidence for that, but there are concerning issues with regards to what Yoko said about the murder.
Don't a lot of the people associated with John, might they not just simply be jealous of Yoko, who's kind of become his main attention?
Yeah, and so I can talk about one, because he's dead now, so he's safely away, and he won't mind me saying this, because he really didn't like it. It was a guy called Tony Bramwell. Tony Bramwell ran Apple Films, and I had a couple of conversations with Tony Bramwell when I first started this investigation. And he knew John when he first started to see Yoko, or when she first came on the scene, and he basically painted her to me as a groupie who just went after John for his money. And there is some evidence for that. It's scant, and it's kind of... secondary evidence, but there is some people have said, yes, she made it quite clear that she was going to go after John for money, because there was a contract that was put together with her husband at this time, a guy called Tony Cox, where if she did manage to snare John, any money that came to Yoko from any kind of inheritance would be split with Tony. And this contract was seen and verified by a friend of Tony Cox and Yoko, a guy called Dan Richter, who was, interestingly, he was an actor, and he was the monkey on 2001 A Space Odyssey. You know, the guy who throws up the bone in the air at the start of the film. That was Dan Richter. That's his claim to fame. But Dan hung out with the Lennons in the 60s and the early 70s. He was a good friend of the Lennons. And I spoke to Dan, and he told me quite straight. He said, yeah, there was a contract. He said, yeah, they did have a contract, but it doesn't mean anything. You know, she still loved him. But I thought, well, if you did a contract with your husband at the time, you know, for splitting any kind of inheritance with him, from John's estate, that doesn't talk to me of love, to be honest with you. It talks to me more of business. And Tony Cox, her ex-husband, was a bit of a grifter. He was a bit of a kind, he had a bit of a reputation, you know, as a kind of film producer, inverted commas, who would get a lot of money for a film that then didn't happen to materialize. And Tony Cox is the guy who managed to kidnap, some people say. Some people say just took away from Yoko her daughter with him, called Kyoto. And Tony went to America in the late 60s with Kyoto and joined a cult over there, a Christian cult. And Yoko says that another reason why she took to John to New York in the early 70s was to try and get Kyoto back, because she knew her daughter and Tony were somewhere in America. So she thought if she could base herself with John Lennon in New York in the early 70s with all of the Lennon power and money, it might help her get Kyoto back. And interestingly, she did get reunited with her daughter, I would say about 10 years ago now, and Kyoto is very much looking after Yoko now. Yoko's 92 at the moment, and she's got, I think, pretty sure she's got dementia. Last time she was seen at an awards event about 10 years ago. She was kind of babbling quite incoherently, and Sean had to kind of step in and kind of speak for her. So I don't think her condition has improved since then. So I don't think Yoko's got anything of interest to say about the murder of John. And we perhaps should get into that a little bit more now. I think we've gone off of Yoko, such a fascinating tangent.
But it is. It's very important context, I think.
It is. Very
it's
important.
Why he was in New York. I mean, you do see more assassinations, political, cultural, over in New York than you do in the UK. But let's get back to the 8th of December 1980.
Yeah, let's go to the official narrative. Let me tell you.
And John was only 40 years old, I believe.
40 years old. They were out recording a track for Double Fantasy, which is an album they were putting together. It was basically, the album had already been released a couple of months earlier in October 1980. Half the album was John's songs, half of them were Yoko songs. You can imagine, you know, half that most people listen to are the John, half the Yoko stuff. After me, it's not really to my taste. But that night of December the 8th, 1980, they're in the studio remixing a Yoko track called Walking on Thin Ice, which they were hoping to release as a single. They left the recording studio at 10:50 p.m. They were supposed to be going to go for a meal at a diner. Everybody at the time who was interviewed in the studio said, oh, yes, John said he was hungry and wanted to go to a diner, have some food before he went home. But he never went to the diner. The limo took them straight to the Dakota, which is the big Gothic building just off Central Park, 72nd Street, where John and Yoko lived. They had an apartment there. In fact, they had multiple apartments in that building, which I'm sure upset a lot of powerful people who live there. But anyway, I digress. So they didn't go to the diner. Years later, Yoko has said that, you know, it was John's decision not to go to the diner. She brought this up in a Desert Island Disc appearance where she just out of the blue said, oh, by the way, when we were going that night home, that dreadful night, it was John who said, oh, I don't want to go and eat. I want to go and see Sean. But Sean was 5 years old at the time, so I'm not sure a five-year-old would be up at 10:50 p.m. at night. But anyway, that's Yoko. That's how Yoko wants to frame it now, that it was John's decision not to go and eat. And it had nothing to do with her, which is quite interesting. That could be true. Who knows? But anyway, they pull up outside of the Dakota in their limo. Yoko gets out first. She walks down this Dakota driveway. Now, it's really important to the listeners to get this geography right. So it's kind of a Gothic vaulted driveway. It's probably about 30 feet in length. And width-wise, we're probably talking sort of 12 to 15 feet in width, so you're talking 30 feet down, 12 to 15 feet across. At the far right end side of this driveway is a gate, an iron gate, and beyond that is a courtyard. But just before that gate on the right is a little kind of wooden porch vestibule with some glass doors, and in that vestibule is some steps that lead up into a lobby. And in that lobby is a concierge's desk and office, and behind the concierge's desk and office is another back office. In the lobby, you can then, on a far right door, the concierge can bug you in, and that is how the Lennons got into their apartment. So they were meant to be going down to that concierge's area through this far right driveway door access, which takes them up into their apartment. So that's where Yoko was heading. I would say probably somewhere between 5 and 10 seconds after Yoko is walking down the driveway, John follows her, again, walking to the same direction, walking from left to right down the far end of the driveway. You've got three interesting people apart from John and Yoko. You've got the doorman, Jose Codermo, who we spoke about earlier, who's often in a gold booth just outside the sidewalk, just outside the driveway. You've got the concierge, Jay Hastings, who lives in the concierge's office, but he's got a window just by the porch vestibule area that he can see into the driveway, so he can see people coming and going. And you've got another character we're going to talk about in a minute, a third interesting individual, a guy called Joseph Manny, who is a kind of part-time doorman, part-time basement crew kind of lift operator, sort of slightly lower down the kind of working ranks than concierge Jay. But Joe Manny lives in the left-hand side of the driveway. There's access. There's a lift, a water-powered elevator lift that allows Joe to come up and down. And down in that sort of left alcove lift area, you can get a lift down to the basement, which is where the basement crew hung out, where all the janitors hung out, and all the cleaning stuff happened. So you've got Dakota Jose Codermo out front, doorman. You've got concierge Jay in the far right area. and you've got lift operator Joe Manny in the left area, up and down in an elevator. So they're the only three people really of interest we need to talk about when it comes to witnesses. Because the first thing I need to say before we get into the actual murder, Tony, is one of the myths that everybody has about this murder is that everybody saw everything. It was like multiple witnesses on the street that saw everything. It was an open shut case. One thing I can say for absolute certainty is nobody saw John Lennon get hit by Mark Chapman's alleged bullets. And that includes Yoko. Because Yoko gave five statements to the NYPD.
Yeah, I mean, she was ahead of him. She was walking ahead of him.
She was walking ahead of him. But in her first statement to the detective, since I've managed to get hold of the lead detective's notebooks and paperwork, which has obviously opened the whole case up for me. So I've got all his statements from Yoko. And in her first statement to Ron Hoffman, which he took at the Roosevelt Hospital, he actually drug set to the hospital where they're trying to save John Lennon. She said to him two really interesting things. She said John got out of the limo first, and she followed him, which we know is not true, because we've got witnesses who saw Yoko get out first, and John followed her. So we know she wasn't saying the truth there, or we could call it PTSD, if we're being kind, but she got that bit wrong. But she also said something quite interesting to Ron Hoffman, which he noted in his notebook. She did not see the shooter. And to be fair to Yoko Ono, it'd be very easy for her to say this, people wouldn't question her on it, she's never said she saw Mark Chapman shoot her husband, ever. So if you ever
It was dark.
But if you ever watch Yoko Ono talk about the event, she'll talk about the limo, she'll talk about the studio, she'll talk about driving to Dakota. But the second that limo pulls up, she normally comes out with something like, it was terrible, or it was really bad, or I don't want to go into it. Or she doesn't ever give detail about what happened. And the reason why this is important is we'll get back to the official narrative and why we now know the official narrative isn't true. The official narrative says that after Yoko walked down this driveway, possibly went into the vestibule upstairs, possibly went to the courtyard, we don't know. Yoko's never given a coherent statement about what she actually did when gunfire was going. But we know that a guy called Mark Chapman, a Georgian guy, was standing outside on the sidewalk. Just to be clear,
he's from the state of Georgia or the country in the near the Balkan?
Sorry, yeah, he's from the state of Georgia. He's a southern boy, but at the time he was living in Hawaii, and it's really important, we'll get to Hawaii in a minute. He's standing on the sidewalk, compelled, as he thought, to kill John Lennon. He became obsessed with John Lennon in the summer of 1980, and he became obsessed with the Catcher in the Rye book, which I'm sure you know, the J.D. Salinger book. And those two things fused together in the summer of 1980, and Chapman started to see John Lennon as the phony within the Catcher in the Rye Salinger phony narrative of that book. So Chapman says, this is Chapman's words, that he got a gun out and started firing. Now, when Chapman went back to the police station that night, when he was arrested, that's all he could remember. He was confused, didn't quite know why he did it, had nothing against John Lennon, he said. He had nothing against the Beatles. He just remembered getting a gun out and firing. He didn't mention where he shot John. He didn't mention what happened to John after he was shot, because he couldn't, because Chapman has never really given a coherent statement or a coherent kind of account of what John did after he was shot, because he can't, because he doesn't seem to have any idea. You would think if you were shooting a man, you'd have some kind of recollection of what that man was doing when you were shooting him. But anyway, I digress.
So John, no, in a way, it's a very important point, because it's similar with Sirhan Sirhan in the RFK assassination.
Exactly. Very important point. So John's now, according to this narrative, getting shot four times by Mark Chapman. Now, Mark, remember, didn't say on the night of the murder that he shot John in the back, but later he starts to say that he shot John in the back four times with five bullets and one miss. That was the kind of narrative that Mark was given to, that was the script he was obviously given to say. So Mark thinks he's done this. Now, John, here's the thing.
Well, hang on, because it may just be that he's, you know, it's a bit traumatic being arrested and everything. After a while, rather than somebody feeding him that information, it might be that once he settled down, he recollects what happened.
Maybe. But here's the problem, Tony. Here's the big problem with it. The medical people who saw John and saw his wounds, a surgeon called Dr. Halloran, and two nurses that were helping Dr. Halloran that night try to save John Lennon when he was brought into the Roosevelt Hospital, they all thought at the time, and they still say today, that John was shot four times in his upper left chest, entrance upper left chest, in the front, not in the back. And they say three bullets passed through John in his upper left back area. So three went straight through. One bullet shot John's left subclavian artery completely away, and the other three did lots of damage to all the vessels around his heart. None of the bullets actually penetrated John's heart, but you can imagine the catastrophic damage that it did to John's heart. Now, they all said, all these medical people, that with those wounds, and these were very experienced surgeons and nurses, they'd seen, you can imagine, Tony, in 1980 New York, you know, they'd been working at this hospital for a few years at that point, they'd seen multiple gunshot wounds in New York at the time, very dangerous city in the late 70s, early 80s. They all said, unequivocally, as did another surgeon who sadly lied about his participation in helping to save John's life, a surgical Dr. Lin, who said that he treated John, but he didn't really treat him, but he was standing there in the room, so he did get to see John's wounds. But they all said the same thing, Tony. They all said, with those wounds, with those four big holes in his chest, in his upper left chest, in a tight professional grouping, by the way, they all said he would have died instantly. He'd have dropped down and died almost instantly. There's no way he would have been able to move more than one or two steps before collapsing.
Yeah, well, let's just look at a specific thing, to do, particularly when you're talking about a small grouping. How far do we think Chapman was away from...
Well, here's the thing. The official narrative is saying that John was near the vestibule when he was shot by Chapman's bullets, and Chapman was seen by a cab driver and a dog walker out on the sidewalk with a gun. Okay, so we're talking possibly 20 to 25 feet away in a darkened driveway. And Chapman was using a .38 revolver, and allegedly he was using hollow point bullets. Now, the problem with a .38 with hollow point bullets is a .38 kicks every time you shoot it, so it's got a chamber, so it has to go around and it kicks. You've got to re-aim, shoot, re-aim, shoot, re-aim. When you're using hollow point bullets, it kicks even harder. So you've got a guy who was a trained security guard. He had some gunfire training when he was a security guy in Hawaii. But Chapman wasn't a military guy. And he's supposed to be able to get off four shots in a tight professional grouping around John Lennon's heart in a darkened driveway, 20 to 25 feet away from John, when he's standing behind him. And this is a major, major problem. So some people say maybe Chapman called out to Lennon. And a lot of sort of, you know, rhetoric around the time, there was a chief of detectives called James Sullivan who held a press conference at 3 a.m. that night in the 20th Precinct Station to 30 or 40 Bain journalists, and he's the guy who first said that Mark Chapman called out to John Lennon. Now, Mark Chapman has never said he called out to John and John turned around. He's always thought he's got John in the back. Yoko Ono, in one of her statements to Detective Ron Hoffman, said, "We walked in, we heard a noise in the street, but we did not turn around." So even Yoko Ono is saying they didn't turn around. But yet, I think Sullivan, he probably knew by 3 a.m. that John Lennon had, because all the cops at the time and all the news reports at the time in the hours after the murder all said John was shot in the chest. Shot in the chest, shot in the chest, definitely shot in the chest. Chest wounds. Coming in, a guy came into the house with chest wounds. But it changed and it had some morph because I think they realised that the actual killer is starting to believe that he shot John in the back. So I think they had to put in an element of doubt in there that John may have turned. And then you started to hear in the days after that that maybe some of John's wounds were in the shoulder. Maybe some of John's wounds were in the arm. But the actual people who saw John's wounds, and these nurses and doctors had, you know, a chance, especially the nurses who took John's body away and washed it and shrouded it, Tony, twice, would you believe? They, you know, when they say they know John Lennon's wounds, they know John Lennon's wounds. And they're unequivocal. He had four entrance wounds, which is slightly smaller, in his upper left chest, and it's like professional grouping. And he had three exit wounds, which is slightly larger when they come out, in his back, in a direct line of fire. The bullet that was nearest his upper left arm stayed in. And they're absolutely, you know, certain about this. So this is a major problem for the official narrative, Tony, because the official narrative and Mark Chapman thinks that something else happened.
So, I guess the obvious question is, who was ahead of him? Do we know?
Well, here's the thing. We need to start looking at what concierge Jay Hastings and lift operator Joe Manny said they saw happen, and what happened after the event, and what they heard, and all that. Because you start to get clues about what was said with the people on the ground. Now, I'd like to tell you, Tony, what Jose Perdomo said he saw. But here's the incredible truth about that. Is Jose Perdomo was taken down to the 20th precinct that night and given a statement to the NYPD. Jose Perdomo's statement to the NYPD that night, Jose Perdomo's statements, plural, to the Manhattan DA's office, have all been concealed. They've never been released to the public. So you've got to ask yourself the question, why are they concealing Jose Perdomo's statements? What have they got to hide? Why are they trying, you know, obviously he said something they don't want people to know. I suspect he saw very little. I suspect he went back into his cold booth and saw very little. But Jose was the guy at the time who was billed as the doorman who saw everything. Though, of course, remember, they concealed his name. They didn't want his name out there. And Jose never gave a press interview. In fact, of the nine people who were around that Dakota that night, you know, the concierge, the lift operator, there was a cab driver, there was a dog walker, there were two other Dakota workers who arrived on the scene fairly shortly after gunfire. None of those people, Tony, were interviewed by the media. Not one. The only person who did give an interview was the concierge, Jay Hastings, so I'll get to it in a second. And the only reason he gave an interview was a Rolling Stones journalist, a guy called Greg Katz, managed to blag his way into the Dakota that night at 3 a.m. when Jay was still being talked to by the police in the back office, and managed to blag a Rolling Stones interview with Jay, because, amazingly, Greg Katz's parents lived above the very driveway that John Lennon was shot in. So he managed to sort of say he was going to visit his parents, and then he just went downstairs to the concierge's office and had a chat with Jay. But let me just quickly get back to the official narrative here, Tony, because this is where it starts to get really ridiculous. We're being asked to believe that John, with these four holes in his back, though we know they're in his front, but, you know, either way will work, this is what they want us to believe he did. And they have to say this because John's body was found in a specific location by the NYPD cops who turned up shortly after gunfire, a few minutes after gunfire. John walks up to the vestibule door on the far right side of the driveway. He pulls open the vestibule door. He walks into the vestibule, which is like a kind of tiny phone booth area. He then goes up six quite steep steps, pulls open two large mahogany doors at the top of the steps. He's now in the lobby area, Tony. He turns an extreme left through a swinging saloon's kind of door that allows him air around the concierge's front desk into the concierge's open front office. He's now walking through the concierge's front office, Jay Hastings' front office. He says to Jay Hastings twice, I've been shot, so incredibly he can still talk. And he walks on, staggers on, runs on into a back office, into another office, where he falls down flat on his face. And that, in that back office flat on his face, is where John was discovered by three NYPD police officers who I've spoken to. And they've all said, yes, when we found him, he was bleeding out, non-responsive, in that back office, face down. He was left face down.
Okay, just hold that picture for a second, because I want to take you on another slight tangent, which is, I mean, having spoken to so many of these police, having seen a lot of the records, yeah. Did they have any suspicions themselves that the evidence had been tampered with?
Not really. I think two of the officers who turned up, Framberger and Palmer, and I suppose the both of them, they said, you know, but at the time they didn't say they thought John had a faint pulse. But we've got to now know that, you know, they said later that we moved him because we thought he had a faint pulse. I think it was a rash act, but what they did, Tony, was they picked him up, Framberger took the arms, Palmer took the legs, and they both carried John out of the back office, out of the Dakota, into a police car. And he was driven to the Roosevelt. So they basically, they kind of spot the crime scene, really. I think they panicked and didn't really do history or the kind of, the crime scene investigators many favours. Because obviously, the minute they moved John, you know, you just don't know. If it would have been much easier if an ambulance, I think they've got them treated him on the scene, and obviously much easier for a kind of criminal investigation point of view if they could kind of, have the body in situ and do an investigation. But I should tell you that literally, I think it was the very next morning, there were no men in white suits in that Dakota driveway. Basically what happened was the driveway was open to the public, not the public, it was open to the Dakota residents who could come and go through that driveway. There were no kind of cordons, there was no DNA, I suppose DNA wasn't much in use in those days, but there was no men in white suits is what I was trying to say. It was business as usual the next day. So I don't think a proper investigation was conducted because they had their man, because what the police officers found when they got there, Tony, was Mark Chapman in a daze reading Catcher in the Rye. He felt compelled to get the book out after he thought he'd just shot John Lennon, and he started reading the novel. So it's all really, really strange, and this is not the way a cold, calculated assassin obviously should react after.
Well, I think the idea is surely that, you know, he's some sort of madman of some kind. And that actually this holding the catcher in the rye is probably some sort of rabbit hole that everyone is supposed to go down. But anyway, look, getting back to John, lying on his face, it's actually, I think you're quite right. I mean, if he's had four shots to the heart area, even though it hasn't actually, I mean, an artery is severed internally, I mean, he's going to most likely lose consciousness pretty quickly. Certainly, if he doesn't lose consciousness, he's going to be falling over. He's going to be lying on the ground outside, surely.
Yeah, exactly. And they had the problem they've got, Tony, is they had to get him running and walking because they knew that they had police officer witnesses who found him in this area. So, they had to kind of concoct this superhuman running story. And here's the problem. The gun, you would think there's a smoking gun there, Tony, but let's get into the gun. Now, Chapman thinks he dropped the gun. He's not quite sure how the gun got on the ground, but there's been reports that the doorman, Jose Perdomo, came over and shook it out of Chapman's hands. We don't quite really know what happened to the gun and how it got on the floor, but we do know a secondary witness in a cab said they saw Jose Perdomo kick the gun to the back of the driveway where the vestibule door is, which, of course, if he's doing that, places Chapman and the gun at the sidewalk front of the driveway, which is quite interesting, so it's quite useful to know that. So the gun has been kicked. We don't know why Perdomo did this. You know, Perdomo was a big, burly man. He could have easily picked that gun up and, you know, walked the gun into the Dakota and given it to one of his colleagues, or he could have put it in his coat pocket, but he didn't want to touch the gun, interestingly, Perdomo. He wanted to get the gun as far away from himself and Mark Chapman as he could. And he did this, you know, via kicking it to the back of the sidewalk. Now, this is what's interesting. Here's where our Joe Manny lift operator comes into the story, Tony. Joe Manny says he hears three bullets. That we heard it was four. He heard three bullets being shot while he was in the basement, Joe alleges. Joe then says he came up to the driveway via the lift in the left-hand alcove, the opposite, the vestibule side of the driveway. And he says he saw Perdomo pacing around a gun. And Perdomo told Joe to take the gun and take it down to the basement and put it in a drawer. So that's what Joe did. He dutifully didn't ask any questions. You'd think he'd sort of go, why are you doing that? What's going on here? But Joe just says he picked the gun up. And with two colleagues, really interestingly, who've both given statements corroborating this, they all went down to the basement and put the gun in a drawer. So when the cops got there, Tony, there was no smoking gun. There was literally no gun at all on Chapman. So whether that gun could ever be verified as the gun that Mark Chapman had, or it was the gun that shot John Lennon, we just don't know. So it's interesting when people often say, oh, the guy was standing there with a gun. He didn't actually have a gun. There was no gun in
it. Maybe it could quite possibly be that he didn't have a gun. There was no gun with Mark Chapman. And yet Mark was one of the reasons why he says, I don't know where the gun came from.
Quite possibly. But here's another interesting thing. This is where the secondary witnesses start to turn up and they give us interesting information, Tony. The first witness who sort of turns up is a cab driver called Richard Peterson. Now, interesting guy. I've spoken to Richard a few times. Richard is one of these witnesses who likes to elaborate, likes to add little extra bits, unfortunately. You know, they hear things in the press and they just bolt those things onto his story, such as Mark Chapman shooting at John Lennon. I've got Peterson's original statement he gave on the night. He doesn't mention Chapman calling out to Lennon, but now when I'm talking to him, he's saying, oh, yeah, Chapman shouted out to Lennon. So he's obviously read that, Peterson, and just bolted that onto his story. Peterson said, and Peterson was heavily featured in an Apple TV documentary called Murder Without a Trial about 2 years ago, is it now it came out? I'm not sure, maybe a year ago. And Peterson, they kind of, this Apple documentary used Peterson as their kind of star witness. Problem is, the way the edit was done in this Apple TV series, they kind of made out that Peterson saw John get shot by Mark Chapman. He didn't. What he said he saw was he saw Mark Chapman standing by the sidewalk. He saw John and Yoko get out of the cab, get out of their limo. He then saw Chapman raise a gun and allegedly fire, and then she said he saw Chapman drop the gun, get a book out, take his coat off, start reading. This is all a very compressed timeline. We know these things took much longer than this. We also know Podermo interacted with Chapman and the gun, but Peterson has never mentioned ever seeing Podermo. When I spoke to him about the doorman Podermo, he said, I don't remember a doorman, which is kind of impossible for Peterson to not see the doorman, because we know he was there by other witnesses after gunfire, saw Chapman and the doorman by the sidewalk, so that's a problem for Peterson. And then Peterson says he ran off for help. But here's the problem with Peterson is, when I spoke to him, I said, so when Chapman allegedly got his gun out and started firing, Richard, where was John? He said, oh, John was way out of sight. He said he was right down the driveway. I couldn't see him. He assumed, because obviously he was a cab driver, he knew the Dakota well, he assumed that John was by the vestibule area when Chapman started firing. But here's another problem for Peterson. Two other witnesses on the night said, and this is verified, that immediately after gunfire, they looked out onto 72nd Street and they saw a yellow taxi fly off down the street at top speed. So Peterson can't say he saw all these things, left his cab on the side of the road and then ran off for help. If two other people said they saw a cab, which must have been his cab, speeding off from the scene at top speed. So whether we believe Peterson or not, we just don't know. But a secondary witness...
Hang on, because there are... Just a minute. There are quite a few cabs in New York. It could be another cab.
Could be another cab, but the other people said they didn't see. See, Peterson's story is he left his cab there, right by the limo, where the limo was. The limo drove off immediately after dropping John and Yank off, and Peterson said he left his cab there when he went running off down 72nd Street to get help. But I spoke to a lot of witnesses who said there was no cab outside the Dakota, including some of the Dakota workers said, no, there was no cab. The cops said, no, there was no cab when they got there. You think they'd spot a big yellow cab. They're quite big, those cabs in 1980 in New York. But no one saw Peterson's cab sitting there by the sidewalk when they got there. So I don't think it was there. And I think after hearing gunfire, I think Peterson drove off at top speed down the road. And I think he double backed. I think he came on the scene. And I think he picked up from various other witnesses what may have happened. And I think he inserted himself as a star witness. And he said, you know, he was really happy that he got himself some kind of recognition and fame. Though interestingly, after giving his statement on the night of the murder, Peterson was never again spoken to by the media until Apple got hold of him 4 years later. So, and I spoke to him at the same time. So, roughly the same time. So Peterson.
Yeah, this sort of thing often happens, doesn't it? I'm just thinking now about, you've made me think about the Diana assassination.
Oh, yeah, right.
And how there were so many people, Brenda Wells was one of them, many people in that tunnel who witnessed exactly what happened. And yet the press, in their wisdom, and in the most of the documentaries, apart from the Al-Fayed one, make no attempt really to track down people who were actually there and saw exactly what was going on. They tend to talk to sort of experts of one sort or another.
Well, this is it. And it's kind of the whole media blackout with regards to the actual witnesses on the ground is incredible. There was a guy called Sean Strube who turned up as they were carrying John's body out, and Sean got interviewed by the media ad nauseum, constantly by the media at the night. He got taken down to the Roosevelt Hospital. They, even after the Roosevelt Hospital interviews, took him to a studio that night and gave an interview. Sean saw nothing. He saw absolutely nothing. He just saw John's body being carried out. But the way the media portrayed Sean, you would think he was a star witness. And so this is, you know, they decided to use the guy who saw nothing as the main witness to John Lennon's assassination, when they could have spoken to Yoko Ono. Obviously, Yoko was never going to talk.
I think you and I should be right in unison right now, pointing our fingers at the editors in a situation like this. Why are you putting this person on the television, on the radio, in the newspaper, when actually what we need is somebody that actually was there and saw what happened? Anyway, I keep interrupting you. I should just let you carry on. What you seem to be coming to is, you know, who it might be ahead of John that actually killed him.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. You've got, I'll just finish off with one more Jose Podermo story. There was a dog walker called Nina Rosen who gave an interview to Ron Hoffman in his notebooks, which thankfully I managed to retrieve when I got hold of his notebooks a few years ago. Nina's been buried as a witness. No media ever talked about it. Albert Goldman, the very famous writer who does a lot of hatchet pieces on Elvis and John, he did a book on John called The Lies of John Lennon, I think in the late 80s. He mentions a woman called Nina Rosen, but he doesn't give any details about what Nina said and saw, but thankfully she gave a very long interview to Ron Hoffman, which I managed to get hold of. What Nina said is she saw them get out of the limo. She went walking off down 72nd Street with her dog. She heard gunfire. After a short while, she doubled back onto the scene. Okay, so Nina's a really important witness. She saw no John, but it was a very darkened driveway, so John's may have been lying there. We just don't know. She saw no gun, so maybe at this point, Podermo has kicked it to the back of the driveway. But what she did see, Tony, was our friend Jose Podermo pleading to Mark Chapman to flee the scene. Now, we've heard this before, because Chapman has said in later interviews that Podermo asked him to leave, and Chapman replied to him, "Where would I go?" But Nina gives a bit more detail. She says Jose, she quotes what he said. She said, Jose said to Chapman, i.e. the doorman said to the big burly man, so we know it was Jose to Chapman, "You better get out of here soon because the cops are going to be here in a minute." Now, to me, that's an accomplice kind of chat. That's not a doorman doing his job. That's not a security guard who should be doing a citizen's arrest. Jose Podermo was a big guy, big burly Cuban guy, big round bull of a man, big thick neck. Why is he telling Chapman to run away because the cops are going to be here soon? That's kind of... That's very suspicious for Jose Podermo for me. That's kind of... And I think what was going on, Tony, was I don't think Mark Chapman was meant to live. I think Mark Chapman was meant to run, and I think they were going to take him out Jack Ruby style, either in Central Park or somewhere down 72nd Street. I think there would have been a rookie cop ready to go, you know, vigilante style, shooting the guy who was fleeing the John Lennon murder scene. I don't think they wanted Chapman to be standing there with a catch in the right book and going back to the 20th Precinct and sort of saying, "I don't know why I did it. I've got nothing against John. I just remember shooting. I don't remember much else." I think that was a big problem for them. And it was the people who piled into Mark Chapman's cell in the days after the murder, I think, that completely revealed who was behind the whole thing. So John, just quickly finishing off with John, he's taken to the Roosevelt, dead on arrival. There's a lot of BS about a guy, an Oscar Moran, who said he spoke to John in his police car. I've spoken to other cops about this. They're embarrassed that Moran even tried to come out with that BS line that John was talking to him in the back of his car. Shocking, you know, piece of elaboration by Moran. But when they got into the Roosevelt, all the doctors and nurses said he was dead on arrival. They tried to save him, they couldn't. The nurses took him away and wrapped him. But here's where things get really sinister. The chief medical officer in New York at the time was a guy called Elliot Gross. And Elliot Gross was due to do the John Lennon autopsy the next morning. Okay, his body was going to get taken to the morgue. I think the morgue van was due to turn up at 1 a.m. It was going to get taken to the morgue. Then it was going to get taken to Gross's office. And he was going to do the autopsy the very next day. But Gross turned up at the Roosevelt that night while the nurses had just wrapped John and washed him, and said to the two nurses, Barbara and Dee, "Can you unwrap John? I want to see his wounds." And they're like, "Well, what the hell are you doing asking that, Elliot?" You know, it's kind of like they didn't think Elliot was who Elliot said he was, because no chief medical officer had ever come in and asked them to do this before in all their experience. So they thought he was some guy just blusting his way in. But when he managed to convince them that he was who he said he was, they were really angry, but they had to unwrap John and sit him up. And he started to, I hate to be gory here, but he started to bleed out, so they were getting even more angry. And Gross walked around John's body, looked at the four in the front, three out the back, didn't say anything, and then walked off. And they were furious, and they had to rewash John and reshroud him. So when those nurses say that they know John's wounds, they really know John's wounds. And the reason I'm telling you this story, Tony, is Elliot Gross only got the job as chief medical officer in New York in January 1980. And unfortunately, before and after John's assassination and autopsy, Elliot Gross has been accused multiple times of falsifying autopsies. So you've got a guy who is probably the most discredited CMO in American history at the time, turns up to do John Lennon's autopsy. And you've got a guy like Elliot Gross, who's in a real hurry, just a few hours where he was due to get John's body to see what John's actual wounds were. So that's highly suspicious what Gross did there. And the autopsy that he performed on John has never been publicly released, Tony, because, you know, Yoko and Sean don't want it released because, you know, I'm sure, as you know, an autopsy is a very private medical record with a lot of private medical details. So I can understand why they don't want that. But some people have managed to access it. And from what I've heard, it all goes official narrative. John's got at the back and shoulder, so covering themselves there. So I don't think the autopsy that Elliot Gross performed was a very accurate one. There's been no photos. I don't think any photos were released or even said that photos were taken at the time. And the police officer, Palmer, who carries on his body out, said he went to attend the autopsy, which is really odd because it really should have been a chief of detectives that did that, not some rookie beat cop like Palmer was. But Palmer said he was given the job to go and do it, and he said that he didn't actually witness the autopsy and actually left the room. So Gross was allowed to perform this autopsy on John in private, or not, as the case may be. And then, unfortunately, Tony, when you get to the sort of Yoko haters, this gives them a fuel for ammunition, 36 hours after the murder, so not the day after, but the day after that, Yoko Ono asks her bodyguard, who'd come back to work, I should say, on the night of the murder. She'd given him a leave of absence in September, so it's 3 months. The Lennons had no bodyguards because Yoko gave him a leave of absence. This guy, Doug McDougall, who was her bodyguard, he came back to work after the murder, literally the night after the murder, or the night of the murder. She gave Doug McDougall the job of taking John's body to from the morgue, from Gross's office, to a cremation crematorium where he was cremated 36 hours after he was murdered. So very quickly, John's body was burnt, so there was no chance of a second autopsy. There was no chance of Chapman's defence to say, hang on a minute, we'd like to, you know, have an independent examination of John. So that kind of rapid cremation was a real problem to get into the truth. And interestingly, Doug McDougall, the bodyguard that Yoko hired to do that job that night, was an ex-FBI bodyguard. Used to work for the FBI, which is really odd. He would hire an ex-FBI agent to be their bodyguard, and then to do something so private as to take John to be cremated on his own. No one else turned up. Yoko didn't turn up to the ceremony. It was just John. And it's kind of ironic in a way, because the FBI, as you know, Tony, were trailing John and, you know, were bugging his phones and throughout the Nixon years were making John's life hell, trying to get him.
John himself, that would be the last sort of person that he'd want to be trusting. And also, what were his plans for his death? If he's made a will or something, did he want to be buried? Did he want to be cremated?
He didn't want to have it. He had a well-known aversion to cremation. Didn't want to be cremated. Said that quite clearly. I believe there was a demo of a song where he even talks about not wanting to be cremated. So John did not want to be cremated. He certainly would not want to be cremated with just an FBI bodyguard standing there, you know, overseeing the whole thing. It's kind of slightly sick, really, that was the kind of person who got to be at John's funeral or funeral ceremony. Very odd. Quite callous, I think. A lot of people said, well, Yoko just wanted to just sort of, you know, it was a kind of Japanese thing. You know, they do very quick cremations over there, but that's not the evidence I found, not that quick.
Where are his remains now? Do we know?
People at the coast have told me that were there that night have said that Doug brought John's ashes back in a brightly coloured box to try and fool the fans that were standing outside the Dakota that's what was in there. Apparently, that, you know, a lot of people corroborated that that's what happened. And some people say, and I think this is probably true because I've heard this from more than one person, that Yoko put the ashes under her bed that night. Now, interestingly, Yoko's got this publicist called Elliot Mintz, who's this kind of strange little guy, real sycophantic kind of publicist. Apparently works for the Lennons for free throughout the 70s, but, you know, he made a lot of capital out of being the Lennons publicist, and, you know, he's been a publicist for lots of Hollywood stars since. But Elliot Mintz released a book recently where he said, or he intimated in a podcast promoting that book, that John's ashes were kept in a warehouse somewhere. So, you know, your guess is as good as mine, Tony. Possibly, there's a lot of, you know, misinformation that they were spread in Central Park, or who knows? Who knows?
I mean, it's pretty amazing, isn't it, that there's no, if what you say is correct, that there's no specific memorial to him.
Well, there is a memorial. They did an Imagine kind of garden thing. It's kind of an Imagine kind of stone, what do you call it, a plaque in the ground in Central Park across the road from Dakota. And you would think that Yoko put that together, wouldn't you? But I only found this out recently. There was a banker guy who worked in the Dakota, and he revealed on a podcast about 6 months ago now. You can find this interview on YouTube. He basically said that the reason why they did this memorial for John, it wasn't Yoko wanting to do some fitting memorial for her husband. It was the bankers who actually through David Geffen, who was managing Yoko's music at the time, they said to David, look, can you go down and have a word with Yoko and tell her that we will pay for a memorial across the road in Central Park for her husband, if she accepts it, our sort of generation donation, because we are sick and tired of having these fans outside our building, you know, with their candles and their guitars, singing John Lennon songs. So it wasn't actually Yoko.
Amazing. This is another question pops into my mind, which is, I mean, is the vestibule still there? Is this all still as it was?
Well, here's the thing. There's two bullet holes in the vestibule, okay, that you can see on some very scant crime photo scenes of the time. You know, they were very much kept under control. We've got some blood in the back office. We've got a picture of that that got released through a UK CD producer. I know he managed to get it released in the mid-80s through an insider at the NYPD. He wasn't going to get it officially released. We've got that one. There's a couple of AP photos that were taken by some photographers on the night, and they show two bullet holes low down in the glass and the vestibule door, too low down for bullet back entrance exit wounds in the top left chest or top left back. So not quite sure why these bullet holes are there. No one can really figure out, including me, Tony, how those bullet holes got there. But what I do know is, talking to Dakota workers who were there the next day, those glass doors were taken down pretty much the next day or the day after. They were then, lots of people don't want bullet holes in a glass door as they're entering the building, that palatial. And these two doors were thrown into the basement of the Dakota. They weren't taken away as evidence. The NYPD didn't take them. DA's office weren't interested. They were thrown in the basement, and then they said about sort of 2 weeks later, the glass panels went missing. They disappeared, and then a week after that, the two handles, door handles, went missing. And all that was left were the frames. And then about a year later, the frames were thrown out. So the evidence on the ground was just discarded, Tony. So there was no reason, really, if you think about it, to do an official investigation, because they had a guy that was standing there, made to order. And I'm often kind of asked, well, why bother with all this kind of Manchurian candidate thing? You know, it's just so convoluted and difficult. And I think, well, is it that difficult when you actually look into MKUltra and what they were doing and the successes they were having? And if you think about it, Tony, if you didn't have a patsy there and John Lennon was shot and there was no one there to pick up the tab, you would have the biggest manhunt in history. And then those doors wouldn't be signed in the basement. You know, and the autopsy would be done more than once. And, you know, you'd have had a thorough investigation. The media would have spoken to everybody, the doorman, the concierge, they'd have spoken to Joe Manny, they'd have managed to get a coherent statement out of Yoko Ono, something we still don't have to this very day, by the way. So, you know, it would have been a proper investigation. But the fact you had a guy standing there confused with a book saying, oh, I think I did it. And, you know, I've got nothing against John. I don't really know why I did it. It was just like one part of me wanted to do it, one part of me didn't want to do it. You know, Chapman was basically outlining what MKUltra is. It's a compulsion that's kind of programmed into an individual through hypnosis and drugs to make them do something that they don't want to do. And we know through Derren Brown and what he did, you know, the famous hypnotist was, you know, you can find this clip on YouTube with Stephen Fry. You know, Derren Brown hypnotized an audience member to come onto stage, you know, all jobs are set up, and get a gun with blanks and shoot Stephen Fry on stage with a gun, and he had no idea what he was doing, on a command, on just one word, command hallucination, he went off and tried to kill Stephen Fry, and this was something that was implanted in him, so we know these things can happen, and we know Chapman had drugs on him, Tony, because I've managed to get hold of some evidence vouchers, and in Chapman's hotel room, on the night of the murder, he did a display, which the media often go into in the DA's office and police at the time talked about this display where he had some photos and he had a music tape and he had the Bible and he had various other little bits and pieces. And it was kind of Chapman trying to tell the world who he was, allegedly. But what they didn't tell us, Tony, is that he had three different types of unidentified pills in his hotel room that they covered up from the public. And that went off for analysis. We still don't know. I didn't find out. There was no paperwork that came back from the lab to tell us what that analysis told us. But one set of pills, Tony, were red pills. As you may know or may not know, Thorazine, which is the kind of CIA MKUltra drug of choice, is a red pill. So you've got Chapman with unidentified pills in his hotel room the night of the murder that was then covered up by the DA's office. So if you want to get into MKUltra, Tony, I mean, this is where the story just becomes, for me, almost laughably obvious. that Chapman was an MKUltra Manchurian patsy.
Well, I think quite a lot of people over the years, I think, have suggested this, so it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. I wonder, what do you think, where, if the gunman was, as you say, inside the building, in the vestibule, or ahead of John somewhere.
Yeah.
Where did they escape to? Did they go into the building, or were they? Well, as you say, you know, you've got to have a trail for this person. Maybe they just went into a flat and stayed there for a few days.
Well, there is that. There's definitely that, Tony. You had three areas where they could be. They're inside the vestibule on the stairway, which is where the lead detective, would you believe, told me he thought John was shot. Forgetting that John's narrative is having been shot in the driveway, I've actually got on tape Hoffman telling me he thought John was shot on the stairs, which is amazing for the lead detective to actually say that. But I'm not so sure now. And my initial sort of thoughts was it had to be in the vestibule because that's, concealed, narrow hallway, stairway. John would have had no time to react. And, if the assassin just pumped him with an automatic weapon four times his height, it would have been a very easy, quick kill. But I'm beginning to think that the problem with that, Tony, is the access in the lobby up those stairs in that festival area when you go upstairs into the lobby, that allows other people had apartments in that part of the Dakota, so other people could have come and gone while the shooter was there. And we know a witness called Jack Henderson came down into the lobby a few minutes after the murder. So they couldn't stop potentially a witness seeing the second shooter in that area. The courtyard is a potential place that you could have been, and the courtyard has other access to and from the building. It's like a big fountain beyond the driveway. There were kind of iron bars, so a professional assassin could have shot John through that courtyard. The only problem with that is it's very hard for us to then see how those two bullet holes got in the vestibule doors if a shooter was placed in that courtyard. I'm beginning to think now, Tony, that probably the best place for a second shooter to be is in the left-hand side vestibule alcove area, and that's where the lift operates down to the basement. There was a little office next to that with a window, so that was a storeroom. So someone could have been in that storeroom watching down the driveway, seeing when John was coming, then they could step out into the alcove just by the lift door. And then John, as you can imagine, John's walking over to the right. If somebody did sort of say to John, "Hey, John," he would just turn slightly to his left, and his upper left chest would have been completely aligned with that left alcove. And what's interesting about that left alcove is, Tony, is that the lift that went up and down in the alcove, just inside it, was a water-powered lift that, if the doors were left open, the people that were in the basement, so Joe Manny's colleagues or Joe Manny, they couldn't call it. It couldn't be used while the doors were open. So if you had someone standing in that alcove with that water-powered elevator behind them with the doors open, they know that no one's coming up through that alcove. They're completely concealed from the street. No one is going to disturb them from the Dakota building, and they've got a clear shot of John in his upper left chest if he slightly turns to look at them as he's walking towards the vestibule on the right. So I'm thinking
I was hinting at it before, but is all this still there?
Yeah, the alcove is still there. The left-hand side alcove is there. I think the water-powered elevator has been upgraded now to a normal electric-powered elevator. But yeah, it's all there. The right-hand side entrance is still there. The vestibule's long gone, but you can still see the steep stairs. No one has actually ever shown a picture, would you believe, of those stairs or the lobby or the back office, which apparently has all been changed now anyway. But no one has ever found or managed to find a picture of the time of those locations, which is fascinating, inside the Dakota. But there's plenty of pictures outside in the driveway. So you can see the left-hand alcove and you can see the right-hand alcove. And there were images taken at the time of those two locations. So people can go online and find these things. And what's interesting is, and slightly damning for our Dakota friends, Jose Concierge Jay Hastings and lift operator Joe Manny, is between the three of them, and I'm not saying any of them had anything to do with John Lennon's murder, but they kind of had the whole area locked down. Dakota Jose had the front sidewalk locked down and he had control over Chapman. Jay had the right-hand side entrance, concierge lobby area locked down. That was his area that he could see and control. And Joe Manny actually revealed in his statement from the time, which was released in the 1992 book, that he came up to the driveway at 10:45 to relieve Jay Hastings so he could go to the toilet. And Joe Manny said he went down to the basement at 10:50 to be with his co-workers, Joe Gresick and Victor Cruz. Only problem with that is, Sonny, that's the exact time John Lennon was shot. So we've got Joe Manny in that kind of left-hand area. We've got Jay Hastings in the right-hand area. And you've got Jose out on the front. And then we've all got to ask, and you've got obviously Yoko, who I think possibly fled to the courtyard. Nina Rosa said she saw her in the courtyard screaming. So between the four of them, they've got every angle of that driveway covered. And here's the problem. Funny, none of them have ever said they saw a second shooter. But here's just one final thing I'm going to say about the people at the Dakota. Is Jay Hastings was reported by various people, and Jay has admitted this himself, he's not trying to deny this, that his shirt was covered in blood. Okay, on the night, he had a white shirt covered in blood. Now, what's interesting about this is, I said to Jay, how did your shirt get covered in blood, Jay? Because John is apparently running past you into a back office. You go in there, Jay told me John was lying on his side. So interestingly, everyone found him face down, so I don't know why Jay left him that way. And he said he kind of looked, he pulled John over onto his back, Jay said, and he could see that he had a lot of blood on his chest. And Jay said, okay, this guy's pretty much dead. There's not a lot I can do here. So he said he went running off for help. Two questions. How did John go from being on his back to on his front by the time the police turned up a few minutes later? So what's going on there, Jay? And how did your shirt get covered in blood? So Jay's got an answer for this, that he's kind of added. He didn't add it on the night of the murder. He didn't mention doing this on the night of the murder to Greg Katz or Rolling Stone. He didn't have time to firm up his story, so to speak. But in 1983, he spoke to Ray Coleman for a Lennon biography, and he's said this ever since. He said, Jay, that the reason he got covered in blood was he helped Framberger and Palmer carry John's body out of the Dakota. But here's the problem, Tony. Here's a big problem. I spoke to Framberger and Palmer, and they said, no way. We carried him out. The consulates didn't help us. I've spoken to cops that were out in the front. They said, no, it was just our two colleagues carrying John out. Even
I mean, this is fascinating because surely Jay, I mean, as we've already heard, it's most likely that John fell outside and was brought in. And, of course, this is going to cover whoever's done this body. You know, shirt or whatever, with blood. I mean, there'll probably be a trail of blood too.
Exactly. So
quite
Jay,
a big one.
Big one. And Jay moves John's body. But I'll stand up in the court now. I'm quite happy to say that I've got incredible evidence to prove that now. Jay moves his body, and Jay has covered up that fact. Yoko Ono has covered up that fact because in a couple of her fragmented accounts from the night, she said. Or she intimated that John went into the stairway, went up the stairs, and she followed him in. And she said, on two of her five accounts, that John said to her, Christ, I've been shot. So John's talking to her, and John's walking up steps. Now, we know he didn't do that. We know he didn't do that, because all the medical evidence, even Elliot Gross, the CMO who's been accused of falsifying multiple autopsies, even Elliot Gross at the time said death would have happened almost instantly. Even he had to say that because the wounds were so catastrophic. Yet Yoko and Jay want us to believe that John was running up steps and through offices. Now, that's a big problem. So Jay, the reason why we know Jay's definitely lying, even Mark Chapman, Tony, would you believe, he was sitting in a police car at the time, in a Barbara Walters 1992 TV interview said that one of the cops who was carrying John, he said two cops are carrying John and one of them swore at him when he was in the car, sitting there handcuffed. And I spoke to Tony Palmer and he said, yeah, that's me. I swore at Chapman. So even Chapman has confirmed that two cops were carrying John out. So Hastings is lying about carrying John out. And Hastings
but
is lying about...
it might be that he did this, you know, spontaneously and then he's covering his own... Or it could
right.
be that he's just thinking, gosh, this dead body's in the way. Let's kind of...
Now, you're right.
He may not even realised it was John, possibly.
You're right. And he may have panicked and maybe thought, oh, because maybe by moving him, I killed him and I could hear things cracking. Or, you know, he said he heard things cracking as he was carrying John out of the cops. And he said that the cops gave him the front, the head and shoulders, because it was the bloody business end, as he called it to me, rather callously. That's how he described it. And he said that they did that because AIDS was a thing at the time. AIDS wasn't a thing at the time, December 1980. He's lying about that as well. So Jay wants an alibi for having blood on his shirt, and that's fine. Because you're right, you might have done it and panicked. And I get why Jay and Joe Manny would cover that up. You know, Dakota workers, friends. They both started working at Dakota in the summer of 1978. So I get why Jay might cover that up with his Dakota pal. But why would Yoko Ono cover that up? for two lowly workers who would have been
interesting. Well, look, I mean, I think it's time that Melody Maker or New Musical Express interviewed Jay again.
Yeah, well, we know what Rolling Stone did. Rolling Stone who did it on the night. Yeah, Jay gave a brief interview when an Apple TV series came out to the New York Post, and he mentions the greatest hits about John running past him, and he went out with a billy club to try and take on Mark Chapman and all this. You know, he's trying to paint himself as a bit of a hero now. I don't think that's what Jay did do. But there's some really awkward questions to ask here, Tony. You know, why was his shirt covered in blood? Why was John left face down? How did a guy with four big holes in his chest and around his heart manage to do all these amazing things, run upstairs, run through offices, pull open doors? It's just, you know, why the cover-up? Why are all the people on the ground covering all this up?
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolutely fascinating tale. Thank you ever so much for sharing with us. Look, the CIA, we know, and MI6, these intelligence services, are definitely involved in one way or another with the death of Jimi Hendrix, with the death of Jim Morrison from the Doors. And so I think we've almost kind of got used to the idea that the intelligence services want to kill these people off. What do you think's the motive?
Well, just quickly before I get to the motive, I just want to say one final thing I want to get in here, and perhaps I'll come back and do another chat with you about what happened after the murder and maybe Chapman's early life, where he was being brainwashed in a Hawaiian psychiatric hospital because one of the doctors who were in that Hawaiian psychiatric hospital said he whistleblowed and said Chapman was being brainwashed with brainwashing techniques and brainwashing drugs. So we know that Chapman was being programmed in Hawaii. But incredibly, Tony, when Chapman was in a police cell, 48 hours after the murder, I think it maybe even 72 hours, I'll give it 3 days, a second lawyer, the first lawyer, the public defender, left the case because he was getting too many death threats. How convenient if you want to get rid of somebody. And then a private lawyer called Jonathan Marks, who worked out of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, got the gig, okay? Should never have got the gig. It was way over his head. But Jonathan Marks got the gig. And Jonathan Marks hired a guy called Milton Klein to go into Mark Chapman's cell. And Milton Klein was a hypnotist. And Jonathan Marks didn't hide this. In the New York Post, there's a headline that says, "Killer to be hypnotized." Because I believe the press found out that Jonathan Marks was hiring a hypnotist. But Milton Klein wasn't just a hypnotist, he was a psychiatrist. But Milton Klein was also something else, Tony. He was the chief, the head consultant on the CIA's Manchurian Candidate MKUltra Create a Murder program. And how do we know this? Because in 1979, Milton Klein went on a documentary. He went on an ABC documentary, which you can find online on YouTube, boasting to the documentary filmmaker that he could create a murderer in a matter of months through hypnosis. And this Mr. MKUltra, Mr. CIA, Mr. Hypnotist was allowed multiple times, and it wasn't just Klein, there was other hypnotists as well with dodgy nefarious links, to walk into Mark Chapman's cell and close the door behind him and have him all to themselves. So everything that Mark Chapman said post-Milton Klein, post the group of hypnotists who got into his cell via Jonathan Marks, to me, it's meaningless. So all these documentaries where you hear Mark Chapman talking on a tape to a couple of journalists called Jim Gaines and Jack Jones going, "Oh, yeah, I did it for fame, and yeah, I just heard did it, and I just wanted to be somebody." And this is all stuff, remember, that Chapman said after Milton Klein had his way with him. So that's really worth bearing
in mind. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? But come on, let's get back to the point. Let's get back to the point, because we need to know about motives and who done it, this sort of thing.
Okay. Here's what I think. I think when Lennon became a bret noir of Nixon back in the early 70s, and they absolutely detested each other, this is on the record, Nixon hated Lennon, Lennon hated Nixon. When Nixon fell on his sword at Watergate, and they had the Watergate hearings, you had Lennon with a buzz cut and a smirking Ono sitting next to him in the audience watching his fall at the hearings, gloating, literally gloating. Nixon and Reagan were quite close. They often, I think Nixon, when he fell, Reagan was on the phone. I think when Reagan became president, Nixon was on the phone. I believe they were good friends. I believe with what Reagan had up his sleeve, or should I say not Reagan, Reagan was an actor. I don't think Reagan knew much what was going on. But the Reagan administration, your Rumsfelds, your Cheneys, you know, the kind of the adventures in Central America, the Iran-Contra affair. I mean, if you just look up, just Google, I don't know, Google, you can't trust Google, but just Google corruption, Ronald Reagan administration, you know, you'll be reading for a long, long time. That was a very corrupt administration. And, of course, you had a certain George Bush, Daddy Bush, working as a vice president in the background. So, you know, this was not a good administration. It was a very hawkish administration who had some really dastardly deeds planned. Here's the problem. Here's the problem, Tony. There are people connected to Mark Chapman, a pastor called Charles McGowan, who is a ex-Navy intelligence officer, ex-US military guy who by daytime acts as a pastor. But he's a serious intelligence dude, Charles McGowan. Charles McGowan identified Mark Chapman as a person of interest when Chapman was 15, and he started to guide and shape Mark Chapman's life right through to today. So if you want to get to Mark Chapman, you've still got to go through Charles McGowan. So Charles McGowan handled Mark Chapman right up until Mark Chapman's, fateful night on December the 8th, and Charles McGowan is handling everything that Chapman has done ever since December the 8th. So he got into his cell, I think 2 days after the murder, McGowan flew to Chapman's side, and with Chapman's wife, Gloria, which is a conversation for another day, a highly dubious woman, they're the two that control Mark Chapman. But here's the thing about Charles McGowan. One of Charles McGowan's good friends is a guy called Joe Rogers. Charles McGowan has gone on record and said that him and Joe were very close. Joe Rogers was Reagan's finance man. Joe Rogers is the guy who actually raised all the money to make Reagan's campaign actually work. Actually, you know, without Joe Rogers, I don't think Reagan would have got into power. And we haven't even touched on the October surprise stuff that's all come out recently with regards to what the Reagan administration were doing with the Iran government. So, you know, I think they would have seen what they had on their slate. They'd have looked at John Lennon and thought, okay, it's been 5 years since all the Nixon stuff, but you know what? He's got a world tour planned next year, which he did have. You know, he was active again. He had a new album out. He had a world tour planned in 81. He was due in January 1981 to go on a march with Asian workers in San Francisco. So he was about to get politically active again. He was about to go on a world tour. He was about to get his green card stamped as he was going to become an official citizen, so they couldn't kick him out anymore. That was about to happen in 81. And, of course, we know Reagan, you know, was inaugurated in January 81. So,
had the American government been kicking John out of New York or what?
No, they tried to. Up until Carter.
I mean, he had lawyers, obviously.
Up until Carter, they tried to get him kicked out of the country for a drug offence that John had on his record from 1969, where a little bit of hash was found.
So he was basically like a persona non grata. Because I can remember him doing a really great interview where he was talking about the Western world being run by psychopaths. This is during the time of the Vietnam War. Effectively, he was a major, major, very, very popular critic of what we'd now call the deep state.
Deep state, and he was a peace activist. You know, he was the original peace activist who was constantly talking about peace and he was anti-war. And I think with all the misadventures in Grenada and Central America, I think he would have detested the Reagan administration and all they stood for. And I think they saw him becoming active again. And I'm not saying Charles McGowan was behind this. I'm not saying Ronald Reagan was behind this. But I think there was I think the way these things are done, Tony, from what I've looked into, is it's a lots of different disparate groups who all come together and say, do you know what? I think if this guy goes, it's going to be good for all of us. It's all of us. You know, we've got a future critic of Ronald getting kicked out. You know, he lives in this Dakota mansion with his witchy wife. You know, and his un-Christian, communist, because everyone thinks, you know, Imagine was a communist song. You can easily be interpreted that way. You know, the commie guy living with his witchy black magic wife. Who's spouting anti-war stuff. You know, we know what he did to Nixon. We know how, he made Nixon's life unbearable. And now we've got Ron coming in. Wouldn't it be great if we just get rid of this problem before it becomes a problem? And I think that's what was done. I think there were two operations here, Tony. I think there was the Manchurian Candidate Chapman operation, which is a separate group of people. And I think Chapman was like Hinckley. I think there were cookie cutter MK Ultra guys, and we know this because a Commander Neurath for Navy Intelligence revealed to a Sunday Times reporter in the mid-70s that Navy intelligence had MK-Ultra assassins all over the world just ready to go. Just, you know, he revealed, they said he had a breakdown, he didn't mean to say it, he was talking hypothetically. He wasn't. He said it, Commander Norat said it to a Sunday Times reporter face-to-face. He said, this is what we have at our disposal. And I think Chapman, Light, Hinckley and various others, possibly Dennis Sweeney, the guy who killed Al Lowenstein as well in 1980. I think all these guys were just ready to be activated. I think they were put through a program, and I think people just had a, you know, it's almost like dial up a taxi. You know, we've got an operation going down. I think the people who actually took out John on the ground at the Dakota was a different bunch of people. I think the people who delivered Chapman to be a bemused, confused taxi were another different bunch of people. But I think all these people would have had the same goal. You know, take out a problem before it becomes a bigger problem. And I think the timing of Reagan coming in, you know, just a month later, you know, it's just something you just can't ignore. And I just think they just thought now's the time. And possibly, you know, I remember Gil Scott Heron, you know, the famous singer, I think he was quite the one to say, you know, what was so callous about them taking out John Lennon was they'd already won, you know, they'd already won the election. So, and he kind of, I think he was implying that it was a kind of, it was almost like a kind of bad faith kind of, you know, we're doing it just because we can kind of do it thing. And it was almost like a kind of grudge. It was like a score that was being settled. And, you know, when you've got people like Bush, I can see them settling a score for Nixon.
Well, it's interesting you mention Bush, because Bush Sr. was a director of Central Intelligence in the late 1970s. I think exactly. The guy who was the director at the time was someone called Stansfield Turner, appointed by Jimmy Carter. But you know, there'd be a lot of. I'm quite sure Bush Senior, who later became the U.S. president, of course, would have had lots and lots of contacts, so may have been able to influence this. The other thing I'd just like to share with you is the, you know, because having looked into JFK, and I think, you know, pretty much bottomed that out about the politics, the CIA being behind it, etc., and the Chicago working very closely with the Chicago. I mean, of course, this is the area that people like Whitney Webber are investigating very thoroughly too.
Brilliant work. Yeah.
The links between organized crime and these government agencies, particularly intelligence people. But you know, the successful shooter, the killer on that day in 1963 of JFK, as he describes it, it all sounds very calm. Once he'd blown the back of JFK's head off with his Remington fireball, he just very quietly crunched on the cartridge that he'd just used, put it on the picket fence, spent a few seconds just folding up the rifle and putting it in a briefcase, and just calmly walked away. So it could be that was the person that did John Lennon, and because they're sort of not rushing or they're not very obvious, that's the way these sorts of assassinations might take place.
Yeah, I think it would have been a professional hit for sure. I think the assassin would have been someone who knew what they were doing. They were going for the heart, obviously. You know, four shots around the heart. They weren't messing about. And I think, you know, there was an exit in the left-hand alcove, there was an exit in the right-hand alcove, there was an exit in the courtyard. If Chapman was in a hypnotic state, which I think he probably was, they could have just walked past Chapman onto 72nd Street and walked on.
Very much like Lee Harvey Oswald, he is the perfect person, just wandering around for everyone to interview if they can, or arrest, etc. Anyway, look, if people are interested in following your work and getting hold of the book, what's the best way to find you and get hold of it?
Best way to find me is, or find the book is on Amazon. It's called Mind Games, The Assassination of John Lennon. I'm working on a second book, which is going to be a collation of all my writings with additions now, because I'm constantly getting new information, Tony, all the time. I've become the kind of hub for the John Lennon assassination, so a lot of new information is going to go probably in the second volume, which I'm working on at the moment. You can find me on Substack, David Whelan at Substack. I'm on Twitter. My handle is Lennon Murder. You can follow me there. I've got a YouTube channel where I've picked out pertinent clips across many documentaries across the decades, which has things that some people have missed. So you can find me there, Assassination of Lennon on YouTube. So, yeah, if you just put in David Whelan, John Lennon, you'll find me. I've been doing this now for 4 years, so there's plenty of stuff out there. And I think there's more to come.
The big question is, why are these people such a threat? And why musicians? It seems to me that some of the people that have been most important in bringing pleasure to the Western world have also been a threat somehow to the deep state. And I can't quite understand why this all is. I think John Potash, I think it was, that wrote the book about many of these musicians in the States particularly being assassinated and why he believes they were assassinated and how he knows that. But what's your take on what threat these musicians pose?
Well, I think, I know you know this, Tony, but, there was COINTELPRO with the FBI, which is an anti-left, kind of a new left organisation that was set up by the FBI to attack the new left, the counterculture, as I saw it, that was emerging in the mid to late 60s. And, that's documented, COINTELPRO was a thing. And the CIA had their own new left that was called Operation Chaos. And, this has all been documented. So the FBI and the CIA were actively going after people who were promoting counterculture ideas, which they saw as a threat to the state, forget the deep state, just the state. And they wanted to keep the status quo. And I think, Tom O'Neill did some great work with Chaos. I'll finish with this, where he's kind of showed that Jolene West was a CIA operative, no doubt a friend of Milton Klein's, was operating out of Heights Ashbury in San Francisco at the time, was in the same building as Charlie Manson and his girls. I think what Tom O'Neill is saying in his Chaos book is that, potentially Charlie Manson was taught hypnosis skills to hypnotize his followers into instigating heinous acts and murders to disrupt the left counterculture. And it kind of worked because after the Sharon Tate murders, the kind of media reaction, even though a lot of it was kind of between the lines reaction, it was kind of like, Sharon Stone, she took a lot of drugs, didn't she? She hung out of a gay hairdresser and, she had a film director, European husband. And this is what happens, you see, when you do drugs and you hang out with lefties, you get murdered. You get taken out, So it's best you just, don't do that kind of thing and just toe the line. And there's a lot to be said for that. And just to sort of fully, come around the circle from our start of our conversation, Tony, we talked about how the poor state of documentaries in our modern world. And, Tom had a recent documentary out on Netflix about his book Chaos, and it was a complete, fluff piece. It was a complete hit piece on Tom. They were talking about crazy conspiracy theorists. Some information got out. They talked about MKUltra, but, it's clearly something that Tom's not going to be happy with, and I've been in communication with Tom. I'm convinced he would not be happy with this documentary. It didn't do him or his work or his book any justice. But I think what people don't understand is, Tony, when you do a deal with someone like Netflix or Amazon or Apple, you have to give up your rights for them to make the program.
And you have to give up your soul.
Yeah, you do, almost.
It's like your legacy captured your legacy.
You're right, but to be fair to Tom, I think, I can't speak for him, but I suspect he probably thought, well, if I get a documentary out that mentions MKUltra, mentions Operation Chaos, mentions COINTELPRO, mentions the possibility of an attack on the counterculture from the powers that be at the time, and then sort of tries to make out I'm a conspiracy theorist, it's all nonsense. It's a bargain I'm prepared to kind of accept.
It's like a pact with the devil. It's like George Galloway on Fantasy Island or whatever.
You're absolutely right, Tony. It is a pact with the devil. And the fact that people like Tom have to make these pacts in our current media world is heartbreaking. And I personally couldn't do it. I've obviously spoken to a lot of producers about my work in the last 4 years, and I have one condition that I will not break, and this is why no documentary's come out of my work yet. I have to have oversight on the scripts. I have to know what they're saying and what they're not saying. I won't allow them to give me a payday and me to sign my rights away and then have them do to me what they did to Tom O'Neill a couple of weeks ago.
The book is there, so that is entirely your own work, I believe. Nobody has massaged it into something else. So it's called Mind Games, The Assassination of John Lennon by David Whelan. David, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony. I really enjoyed it.